All right, guys. Well, today we are going to be talking with Ross Patterson. He is from Anchorstone International. You can find out more about him if you go to anchorstone.com/Ross Patterson. And so he's a really interesting guy. I really hope you check out these videos. But today we are going to be talking about the location of Sodom and Gomorrah, the true location. And in fact, if you look at this video right here, this is just an amazing video. I hope you guys check out on his website there, Sodom and Gomorrah, true location found. That's what we're going to be talking about. Has the true location to Sodom and Gomorrah been found, been unearthed? And, you know, a lot of people believe Sodom and Gomorrah has been totally lost forever. But, you know, I believe that they have found Sodom and Gomorrah, and I think this evidence is very compelling. So last week we talked with Jerry Brown. He is the director of Anchorstone International. This week we're going to be talking with Ross Patterson. So we should begin him on the line here in a few minutes. We're going to be talking about, you know, the latest findings. We're going to be talking about the Ebla tablets. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, never even heard of the Ebla tablets. But the Ebla tablets are a fascinating discovery that was unearthed. And so we're going to be talking about that today. We're going to be talking about just the ruins. Where is it? And so on. So I really hope you guys share this live stream with people, because, you know, this is very interesting information, especially if you love stories about the Bible and you're interested in archaeology. You know, this is the episode for you guys. So make sure you tune in to this. Make sure you thumbs up the video, and make sure you support us by going to our Patreon account. You can subscribe to our Patreon account, just $1 a month. Really helps us out. And, you know, I want to quickly, because I don't think a lot of people understand what the perks are for Patreon. And it's something that I wish I pointed out more, but there's a lot of perks. If you're a $5 Patreon supporter, you get 5% off the entire store. If you're a $20 or up Patreon supporter, you get 10% off the entire store. And, of course, you're going to be able to join us for Patreon-only exclusive live streams. You're going to be entered in for chances to win, you know, this stack of items we're giving away at the end of the month here. So a lot of different DVDs and books we're going to be giving away here the last day of the month to our new Patreon supporters this month. So if you become a Patreon supporter, you'll be entered in for a chance to win this. We're going to be giving away this 1861 Confederate note. So a lot of cool giveaways we're doing at framingtheworld.com. Let's get into today's program. If you guys, one other thing I want to bring up is, if you guys have any ideas for, you know, guests on the show, you know, email me at Paul@framingtheworld.com or live@framingtheworld.com. Or even better yet is, I'm hoping I can get some, I wish I could, I need to make videos letting people know who's going to be on for the next week, and then you guys can call in. But you guys can call in at any time, 480-519-4999. That's 480-519-4999, and just leave a message. And we'll play that message on the air. So if you just want to call and just say, hey, I support you at Framing the World, thank you for all you're doing, just anything like that, just give us a call, leave us a voicemail, and we'll play that message on air. I want to do more of that. Or if you have like a question for a guest we're going to have on, you can do that as well. So I need to make more videos promoting the guests. I just haven't had time lately. But again, guys, support us at framingtheworld.com. You can donate directly through the site. And, you know, that's really super easy to do as well. Just go to framingtheworld.com, you know, click on store or shop now, and just go down to the donation tab. And we're trying to raise about $800 here to get some hard drives for the show. We definitely need to buy a few hard drives. We're kind of in crisis mode at this point because we need to get a new hard drive immediately. So if you want to become a sponsor of the show, make sure you support us. And, you know, while I'm thinking about it, I want to, you know, thank a sponsor of the show. And it's a sponsor I keep forgetting to mention, but the Romans Road app is a sponsor of this episode today. Make sure you support them, guys. Download the app. Check it out. There's a lot of Bible preaching on there. And there's also the Bible in audio on that app. So if you want to just listen to the Bible on audio, it's a great way to do it through that app. So again, Romans Road app. Just type that into your app, your search engine, and that'll pop up there. But let's get to today's episode. Ross Patterson, how you doing today, sir?
Pretty well, thank you.
All right. Well, can you start off by just telling the audience a little bit about yourself and about what you do?
Sure. I'm a computer programmer by trade, but for many years I haven't actually done any contract work in that area like I used to, because I've been so involved in following up the research of Ron Wyatt and also doing presentations on these things. It's taken me to places like Japan, Australia, around the Pacific Islands, Taiwan, Philippines, doing presentations on the biblical discoveries that he pioneered. And it's led me at this point, we're doing some research in Turkey, and we are working on, and we believe we're going to get very soon, a permit to excavate the Noah's Ark site. But that's another whole topic again.
Wow. Well, that's exciting. So how long has that been in the works?
Well, people have wanted to excavate that site ever since it was rediscovered by Ron Wyatt back he first went there in the 1970s. And people have tried on and off for years to get government permission to do an excavation, and it's never been forthcoming. But last year I got invited to Ankara, and I have a contract with an organization in Turkey. It's a non-government organization called TÜTEP. That probably doesn't mean anything to you. Let me just show you something here. In Turkey, to make them World Heritage Sites. So they invited me to join their organization.
Nice.
And we are working now with the Ministry of Tourism and Culture to get full permits. In fact, we would be excavating this year if it wasn't for the COVID-19 situation.
Yeah, that's kind of got everyone's plans on hold. I was actually going to make a trip over to Israel this year and go to the Sodom locations. And that all got put on hold as well.
Yeah, that's what happens, unfortunately.
Yeah.
A little tiny virus has stopped the world.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's another issue altogether.
Well, a lot of people, you know, obviously Christians believe in that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is a real story. But, you know, a lot of people listening even to this stream, you know, might not believe that. Why do you believe that these are real events, and that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plains being destroyed actually happened?
Well, that's a good question. It comes down to your world paradigm. If you start with the Bible as being the Word of God, which I do, as do, you know, genuine Christians do, stories like Sodom and Gomorrah, Noah's flood, for example, the Red Sea crossing, these are not parables, these are not myths. They're written as history in the Bible. They're written as, this is what took place. This is not some sort of dream or imagination, but it is history. It's tightly woven with the history of Abraham. Abraham was there. He was an eyewitness to the destruction of these cities. His nephew was living in Sodom. So if you take the Bible as a history book, then these cities have to be somewhere. And there's evidence coming out now through archaeology that backs up how significant this was. For example, archaeologists digging in Jordan have unearthed large cemeteries where the Canaanites of the time of Abraham were burying their dead. And these cemeteries are huge. They're massive. They've found, so far, they've excavated three out of these five cemeteries, and they estimate, so far out of those three, they've found 1.5 million graves. Now, obviously, when God destroyed the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, that process stopped. You know, the Canaanites were destroyed, and they were no longer using these cemeteries. But to have cemeteries of that size shows the size, the scale, the enormity of these cities. They were not little tiny villages. These were big cities. And so if that's the case, there's got to be some evidence somewhere of where they were. And thanks to the research of Ron Wyatt and others who have followed up since, yeah, we believe we know exactly where they are. And what's found at these locations is exactly what you'd expect to find. If you think through the Bible story, you have cities. And what were the cities made of? Largely limestone. If you go to Jerusalem today, you'll see the city walls all made of limestone. The buildings are made of limestone. So you picture limestone cities being destroyed by fire from heaven and brimstone, which is another word for sulfur. Now you think about the temperatures involved in fire from heaven. Think about the story of Elijah. Remember when there was a showdown on Mount Carmel between the prophets of Baal and Elijah, and each group, the prophets of Baal, made an altar and put a sacrifice on it and tried to get Baal to light the sacrifice, and nothing happened. Then when it was Elijah's turn and he prayed for fire to come down, the fire that came down, it says, burnt up the stones even, vaporized the stones. So we're talking, when fire comes down from God out of heaven, that is super hot. We're talking supernatural temperatures here. And so if you burnt entire cities made of limestone with that kind of heat and you put sulfur into the mix, you're going to have left behind an ash that is a sulfate. And indeed, there's these large areas and geometric shapes within them of calcium sulfate ash. And when we've had these analyzed in the lab, the reports say these are very clean. The lack of trace elements is significant. And that's exactly what you expect to find in ash from an intensely hot furnace. Anything that can be burnt or vaporized has gone up in smoke and left behind very pure, clean ash. And that is not natural. You don't find that in nature. You know, formations that are lacking in trace minerals. It's consistent, though, with ash from a fire. So, yeah, I hope that answered the question.
Yeah, well, you know, God said in 2 Peter 2:6, in turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemn them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that after should live ungodly. So the Bible says that he turned it into ashes. The rocks even into ashes, the whole city into ashes. And that is just a fascinating thought to think about, how you could turn rocks and limestone into ashes. Real quick, so in Genesis, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is in Genesis 18 and 19. It talks about how they were consumed by fire and brimstone. Can you talk about the story and kind of set up what exactly we're talking about?
Sure. The Bible describes that area as being like the Garden of the Lord or the Garden of Eden. Now, this area, when you go there today, you drive down from Jerusalem, say, down the highway, down to the Dead Sea, where these places were. You're going below sea level. You're 400 meters below sea level when you get to the Dead Sea. And obviously, it was a very good climate. It says in the Bible that it was well watered. If you go there today, it's a very dry desert. And you've got the salt sea down the bottom, but it's a very dry desert. But back in Abraham's day, it says it was well watered everywhere, like the Garden of the Lord, or like the Garden of Eden. And in fact, that's been confirmed by what the archaeologists find in these graveyards of the Canaanites. When the Canaanites were buried, they were buried with large pots with food. You know, some cultures had a belief in an afterlife and they had to give them food and things for the next life. So they'd bury these people with food. And when the what's called a paleoethnobotanist, which is someone who examines ancient botany, has examined the contents of these jars, they found wonderful things. They found dates, figs, peaches, all a whole manner of stuff that you think, wow, there's obviously a very good climate to grow all these things. Watermelons is another one. They found watermelon seeds. So back in the days of Abraham, this was a very lush, fertile, well-watered area. And so these cities obviously flourished there because it was a good climate. They could grow food in abundance. They had, in fact, I can't remember the reference, but the Bible talks about how they had an abundance of food and plenty of idle time. And so these cities obviously flourished, plenty of food, nice climate. And, you know, there's a saying that Satan finds things for idle hands to do. Have you heard that expression? And so what the inhabitants of these cities got into was, well, to put it bluntly, sexual perversion. The term Sodom is used even today in the English language for, it's the root word for sodomy. And so this, what's a polite way to say it? This lifestyle was obviously spreading, and God thought he needs to put a stop to it before it destroyed the whole world. Remember, God had to destroy the world at the time of Noah because the world had become so wicked. So here was, if you like, a cancer starting again in the world, which God had to stop. So he came to Abraham and said, I need to destroy these cities. And Abraham reasoned with God. You can read the story where Abraham said, what if there's 50 righteous people there? And God said, no, I wouldn't destroy it if there's 50 righteous. And then he said, well, what if there's 45? And then 40, and he went all the way down to 10. What if there's 10 righteous people in these cities? And God says, I would not destroy it if there's 10 righteous there. Well, how many did he find when the two angels went down to Sodom? How many people listened? Lot invited these two angels, they looked like humans, obviously, into his house. And then the house got surrounded by the inhabitants of the city, we're told, demanding that Lot send these two strangers out that they may, well, to put it politely, rape them. It says, know them carnally in the New King James. And Lot said, my brethren, don't do so wickedly. And they would have probably killed him. And the angels opened the door and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door and said, get out of this place. God's going to destroy it. And the story goes, Lot went to his sons-in-law, who had married two of his daughters, and said, get out of here. God's going to destroy this place. And it says in the Bible that he appeared as one that mocked unto them. In other words, they didn't take this seriously. And then the story goes, the angels just took hold of Lot and his wife and his other two daughters and literally took them out of the city, dragged them out, and said, go, get to the mountains. And then God sent down fire and brimstone to destroy the cities. So that's sort of the background to what took place. These were obviously on a busy trade route, so the, should we say, the perversions that were going on in the city would have spread further and further. So God stopped it, nipped it in the bud, so to speak.
Yeah, and these weren't just a couple of cities, because when we think of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, we think of Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, we don't think of the other cities of the plain. When God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, can you explain that it was the cities of the plain?
Yes, the Bible describes, it's when Moses is writing about this 400 years later in Genesis, he says, he talks about the Vale of Siddim, or the Valley of Siddim, he says, which is the Salt Sea. So when Moses wrote Genesis about 400 years after, he could say that what used to be the Vale of Siddim, or the Valley of Siddim, was then at his time already the Salt Sea, what we call the Dead Sea today. And the Bible talks about a battle that took place in this valley where there were invading armies coming in, and the kings of these cities went out with armies to meet them, and they had a battle in this Valley of Siddim. Since then, the geography's changed, obviously. The Dead Sea has filled up with water, and the water is so salty if ever you get over there and you float in the water, you bob like a cork on the water because the water is so dense. There's so much dissolved solids in the water. I will warn you, if you do go there, and if you have a scratch anywhere on you or on your foot and you get in, you'll feel that straight away.
Yeah.
The water is so salty. And a little clue, don't dive head first into it. If you get it in your eyes, and you'll know. We were there one time and someone had just done that when we pulled up. And he was coming out saying, "Help me, help me." And people took him over to the showers because they have showers near the Dead Sea where you swim to rinse all the salt off.
Yeah.
So if you go there, don't put your head under the water.
Yeah, I can relate to that. That's funny. Well, that verse you were talking about earlier was, I think you're referring to Ezekiel 16:49, where it says, "Behold, this is the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness." And so, these were very rich and wealthy cities at that time. They had a lot of trade and industry. You know, in the discoveries they made in those graves, they did find a lot of like exotic fruits and nuts. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, obviously, before God destroyed these cities, it likens it to the garden of the Lord. It was well watered, and there was a valley there. You know, the fact that it's below sea level probably enhanced that. I don't know if you've heard of the concept of a hyperbaric chamber, where they use it in, say, sports medicine. And apparently, if you're in a hyperbaric chamber and they up the oxygen level, any cuts or wounds heal much quicker. I don't know if you're aware of that. And there's been experiments where they've put plants inside higher pressure with higher oxygen, and the plants do very, very well. It could be that before the flood, the atmosphere that we now live under was actually denser. And they've also analyzed oxygen levels. You know when they find preserved insects in amber? You know the amber where they find preserved insects? Mm-hmm. They've analyzed the air and the air bubbles within the amber. And typically, it's more like 30% oxygen rather than like the 19.5 or whatever it is that we have today.
Oh, interesting.
So, and you know, before the flood, there were giant insects. They find in the fossil record, they find dragonflies with 1 meter wingspans. They found centipedes 8 feet long. You know, so obviously in those conditions, things flourish very well, especially insect life. Now, when you go 400 meters below sea level to the Dead Sea, you're actually in a mimicking, if you like, of a hyperbaric chamber because you're under higher air pressure. Not a huge amount, but it's significant enough that perhaps when the place is well watered, plant life would have flourished even better there than elsewhere. So that could have led to, as that text you're reading, where it says they had plenty of food, I'm paraphrasing there, an abundance of bread. They weren't short on food because probably the conditions were just perfect for growing. And so they didn't have to eke out a living just to feed themselves.
Yeah. Well, one of the proofs to the Sodom and Gomorrah story outside the Bible is the Ebla tablets. And that's something that really fascinates me, is those findings. Can you explain what is the Ebla tablets and how was that discovery so monumental?
Yes. Ebla or Ebla, not quite sure how you pronounce it, is a place up in Syria. And it's what you call a tell. If you go across countries that have been inhabited for centuries or millennia, should I say, like Turkey, you'll find all over Turkey, for example, what are called tells, T-E-L-L. And the effect of they're a man-made mound that used to be a city or a town. And as the town would get destroyed, perhaps by an invasion or just as it grew, they'd level it out and build on top. And so these man-made mounds slowly grew in height. And then when they ceased to be inhabited, they're just like these man-made mounds, which if the archaeologists dig into, you'll find building ruins and other archaeological evidence of the cultures that were living there. And so Ebla was a Tel Marduk, I think it was called, from memory, in northern Syria. And when the archaeologists came to excavate it, they discovered it was the old city of Ebla. And one of the tablets said there's a population of about, I think from memory, it was about 260,000 people living there. So it was quite a sizable city. And this city had obviously been destroyed by an invasion, because when they came to the palace ruins and they began excavating that, they found the royal archives, like a library, where there had been shelves of these clay tablets written in cuneiform script stacked up. And obviously, perhaps the palace got burnt down in the invasion. And this library of tablets was just left where it all collapsed down. And so that was a real treasure trove for the archaeologists. Here's this library of tablets. And when they started translating them, they found names which matched biblical names. Like apparently they found, like, Abraham was a name they found. And they came across the names of Sodom and Gomorrah. And apparently one of the tablets listed the whole five cities. You know, the Bible mentions five cities: Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and what was the other one? Admah. And so here's these five cities mentioned in these tablets. So clearly they dated back to the same time period, and they were known as cities that were flourishing in the days when Ebla was an existing town.
Yeah.
And that was the first time these places were mentioned outside of the biblical record.
Yeah, which is just more proof that the Bible is true. Can you talk about Josephus? Now, Josephus wrote that he knew where the locations of the city of the plains were back then. Can you talk about that?
Yes, Josephus was a first century Jewish historian. So we're talking about 2,000 years ago, a little less. Now, of course, the events of Sodom and Gomorrah took place in the days of Abraham, which is almost another 2,000 years before Josephus. So we're talking 2,000 years after Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. Josephus wrote, and he said in his writings, he said, the traces, the remnants of those cities can still be seen today. And that was 2,000 years ago. So clearly, even in his day, there was enough evidence. And that's significant because people have speculated that maybe these cities were in the Vale of Siddim. Now they're under the water, under the Dead Sea, and so you can never see them. But that's wrong for two reasons. And one is the Bible calls them the cities of the plain, not the cities of the Vale, because you had this large plain, and in the middle of the plain was this valley. They're not called the cities of the valley, they're called the cities of the plain. And the fact that Josephus, 2,000 years later, when the Dead Sea was full of water, he could say, you can still see the remains of the cities. So therefore, based on that, the cities are still visible today outside the Dead Sea. They're not under the Dead Sea. And indeed, where they've been located is on the plain around the Dead Sea, visible today.
Yeah, one of the topics that I forgot to bring up when we were talking about the wealth of Sodom and Gomorrah was the bitumen pits. How do you pronounce that?
In English, we say bitumen.
Okay. So now I know this is speculation on your part, but do you believe that that was what created a lot of the wealth?
Possibly, yes. It talks about the Tower of Babel was cemented together with this. So obviously, biblically speaking, it was used as a building material. It must have been quite a good resource. So yeah, we don't know, but it could well be that the wealth of these areas was to do with mining stuff and selling it as a building material or whatever they used it for. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, can you explain what it is for people who are like, what are you guys talking about? Like, what is the substance and where was it located?
Well, it talks in the Bible about in the Valley of Siddim were these slime pits, which would be the bitumen. And it's interesting when they had the battle down in the valley that it called, these were significant in that battle. It's bitumen, I guess, is like a byproduct of the process that generates oil. You know, when oil companies go mining for oil. This is related to that. So it appears that, I don't know if you know, but the Dead Sea, or the Vale of Siddim, is part of a big fault in the Earth's crust. It runs all the way through, down through the Gulf of Aqaba. You know, the Gulf of Aqaba is really deep, because the Dead Sea is right in line with the Gulf of Aqaba. And that fault in the Earth's crust goes all the way into Africa, and it's called the Rift Valley when you come to Africa. You might have heard of the Rift Valley there. So this is like a big fault line in the Earth's crust. And obviously during Noah's flood, this must have been quite a deep crevasse when the Earth's crust actually cracked open and obviously filled with material. And whatever it was underneath the Dead Sea area must have been quite valuable. And even today, there are large mining works on the shores of the Dead Sea, and they extract magnesium out of the Dead Sea water and other materials for fertilizer works and things. So this must have been a mineral-rich area. And, yeah, that's probably why it made it attractive for cities to flourish there. They had, you know, minerals to mine, this bitumen, and a lovely climate, you know. So that's probably why people got established down there. Today, it's just a dry desert. You think, who would want to live down here? It gets really hot in summer. But obviously, the climate was much nicer back in the days of Abraham.
Yeah, I was watching a video that you did when you were out there, and you look so hot. it gets really hot out there. So
exactly, and the landscape just looks so barren. Just the mountains are just, you know, nothing green on them at all. You get these little shrubs where you might get a little dry stream bed, but otherwise it's just barren as, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, for those of you who are a little unsure what we're talking about, I really encourage you to go check out Ron Wyatt's video that he made on this subject. I think just type in Ron Wyatt, Sodom and Gomorrah on YouTube, and you can find it. It's a fascinating, fascinating story. I guess I kind of want to just talk to you about your experience going out there for the first time and looking at these sites. Do you believe that, I mean, did it seem very convincing to you actually laying eyes on it?
Yes. The first time I went there was, when was that, 1999. And driving past, I mean, we knew what we were looking for. We had someone take us there who knew this area very well. She had traveled with Ron Wyatt many times, and Ron had used to show all these things. She took groups, and so she showed us around. We were actually hoping to meet Ron Wyatt on location, but he wasn't well at that stage. So he said, look, meet up with this lady. She will show you all the places. So she took us there. And as you drive down the road beside the Dead Sea, and you glance across and you can see these whitish areas, if you just look at them superficially, it looks like it's part of the natural landscape. But when you go off the road and go and investigate these areas, you start to see things that don't stack up naturally. Now, obviously, it's been nearly 4,000 years, 4 millennia, since these cities were destroyed. So naturally, there's going to be wind erosion, rain erosion. But still, you can discern geometric shapes, square shapes of the ashy material. These places look like towers, perfectly round towers. There's mounds that have like steps in them, and there were holes where perhaps they had beams inside a building going through. When you look at the material itself, it's many, many layers of fine material alternating between calcium sulfate and calcium carbonate. You ask yourself, what natural process would build up layer upon layer like that? Now, some have said, well, maybe water, maybe it's sedimentary deposits from the lake built up all these layers. But you ask yourself, what process in a lake builds up these alternating thin layers? It's almost like a switch, calcium sulfate, calcium carbonate, calcium sulfate, calcium carbonate, one after the other. And part of the problem with that is these materials are very powdery. If you pull some out, you can crush it in your hands. Yet if you mix it with water, it goes rock solid. Because what's a good analogy? Do you know what I mean by plaster of Paris?
Yeah.
Right. You know, like somebody breaks their arm, they used to put a plaster cast on their arm. That plaster cast, the material they use, is calcium sulfate. that have powdered calcium sulfate, mix it with water, and it sets quite hard. You know, that's why people have their arm in a plaster cast to stop their arm moving. So if you mix water with calcium sulfate, it goes rock hard. And yet these layers on the top, yes, you have a very hard layer where the rain has splashed on it. But you get below that rock-solid layer and you find it's all powdery. So how could water have laid down these layers and it still remained a powder when it's evident where rain and water does get on it, it does go hard, but underneath it's still powdery. Do you know? Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So how could a lake deposit these layers, and what process would make it alternate between two very pure substances over and over and over? But if you look at the concept that Ron put forward, that this is what they call thermal ionization, where you get an intensely hot fire. Basically, what's there becomes almost like a plasma, and it starts separating out as the ions repel and attract each other. So it separates out into these layers. And there are places where these layers go in a swirling pattern like this, and other places where you can find where it concentrates on a point, as if there was something distorting the flame there. And then, of course, you find embedded in these places, you find bits of charcoal. So something was burning there. And, of course, along the top layers, you find these sulfur balls. The only reasonable explanation is this is the remains of buildings made of limestone that were burnt with an intense heat, super intense heat. I mean, to illustrate how hot that had to be, if you get a block of concrete, for example, and you get a blowtorch and start burning this block of concrete, will you turn that block of concrete into ash? No, you won't. You might blacken the surface. But to turn meters and meters of limestone all the way through into ash, that had to be supernatural heat. You follow what I'm saying? And so this makes sense. And of course, as I mentioned before, when we had these analyzed, we took samples, had it analyzed at a lab, they say this is very clean, that the absence of trace minerals is significant. This is more consistent with ash. So yeah. Here we have piles of ash in geometric shapes with sulfur balls and charcoal embedded in it. Can you think of any story in the Bible that could produce something like that?
Yeah.
It's in Genesis 18:19.
Well, I think the sulfur balls are the most telling, because when you look at just finding all these sulfur balls all over, especially after 4,000 years, you're still finding them. And, you know, if Josephus knew of them existing, most people back then must have also known. And I'm sure they went to those sites and picked out sulfur balls of their own. And so, you know, just throughout the years, you know, you can see how, you know, the evidence would slowly be taken away. But it's still there today. It's just fascinating. Now, were those sulfur balls, are they just around a lot, or is it harder to find them now?
To be honest, if you go to the sites that Ron publicized, like Sodom and especially Gomorrah, or just underneath Masada, it is getting very hard to find them because so many people have obviously seen these videos and gone there and collected bags. I've got videos when we first went there of school kids. There's a school trip, a Bible school trip came down, and the kids had bags full of these sulfur balls. They've been hunting around finding them. So they are hard to find now. But I tell you what, if you go to some of the sites in Jordan, and there are some over there too that might have been related to this, maybe a temple complex over there, and these are out-of-the-way places, they're all over the place. They're very easy to find. But where they've been picked over by the tourists, it's getting harder and harder to find now, on the surface anyway.
So yeah. So I guess it's kind of a mixed bag where it's like it's not, you know, it's cool to get the story out and let people know about this, but, you know, one of the verses I read earlier is that 2 Peter verse where it talked about the Sodom and Gomorrah was an example unto those that should live after. Can you explain just how, you know, it could only be an example, you know, an example if you could see it and look at it.
Exactly. That's a very good point. The fact that the Bible says these are an example or an example to those who are after means it's got to be something that people can see. And that ties in with Josephus saying the remains are still visible in his day. And I guess here's an interesting point. When God sent down fire on the altar that Elijah had built, it said the stones were consumed. Now, if you add sulfur to that sort of reaction, the sulfur would react with the limestone and remain there as an ash. And so perhaps God added the brimstone into this chemical reaction, if you want to call it that, with the fire and the brimstone being added as well, for the purpose of leaving the ash behind so that centuries after his people Israel living next door could see these as a reminder. You know, there they are. That's the remains of Sodom and Gomorrah right down there, you know, next to the Dead Sea, as a reminder of what took place in the days of Abraham. And that probably helped keep Israel reminded that God did not tolerate that kind of abuse, should we say.
Wow.
So that would fit.
That's a fascinating thought. Yeah, I mean, this whole conversation is just so interesting, and that's why I wanted you on, because I watched a few of your videos that you, that lecture you gave. It was just so well put together, how you broke down all these different facts, and I really encourage you guys to go watch that presentation, because it really does make you just kind of just stand in awe of how God, you know, did this.
Something else we didn't touch on is the actual sulfur balls themselves are significant, because when we took them to the lab to have analyzed, these sulfur balls are a very pale white, almost creamy color. You know, sulfur is normally sort of, here's an example, this sort of yellow color. I don't know if you can see that. Mm-hmm. But the sulfur balls are almost white, almost like a very pale creamy color, not the bright yellow that we're used to seeing with sulfur. Here's another example of something yellow. You know, sulfur is normally this sort of color, very bright yellow, but the sulfur balls are almost a whitey cream color. And when you pull them out, it's in a form of like chalk, or how do you say in America, chalk, you know, the stuff you write on a blackboard with. Very soft, powdery. You rub your fingers on it and your fingers are coated in powder. So it's almost like pressed powder balls of this very pale white sulfur. And when we had it analyzed, it's actually extremely pure. The form of these sulfur balls that you find at these sites is extremely pure elemental sulfur, but it's in a form that's like pressed powder. When we had it analyzed at the lab, they said, this is interesting because this is what they call monoclinic sulfur. Here's a little bit of a chemistry lesson. Sulfur is normally what they call rhombic. It's where you get eight atoms of sulfur forms a ring, and that's the sulfur molecule. But if you cook that sulfur, if you heat it up, it'll break down into individual atoms, and they call it monoclinic. And that form doesn't last really long before it reverts back to the rhombic type. But yet this sulfur we find at these sites is still monoclinic. And yet here it is down in the open, embedded in all three of these ashen formations. And you take the Bible story that God sent down fire and brimstone from heaven. This is of divine origin. And it makes sense because it's totally unique. The form you don't find anywhere else in the world. And yet there it is. You can go and collect your own sample, take it to a lab and say, tell us about this. And they'll say, this is, you know, not as it's normally found in nature.
Yeah.
So well, there's all part of the ensample to the world, you know.
Yeah, and it's more proof that, you know, these are legitimate sulfur balls. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Why is this conversation important? Why do these things matter?
Well, that's a good point. If we go back to the words of Jesus himself, and this is what Christianity is all about. It's all about Christ. that outline prophecy in Matthew 24. He said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And he also said, as it was in the days of Lot. Do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
So reminded us of what took place in the days of Lot. He says the people, they were planting, building, etc., and knew not until the day that Lot was, basically, I'm paraphrasing, taken out of the city and destruction came. So Jesus reminded us, he pointed that to that as an example. Here were these that had the witness of Lot. They must have known about Abraham. If you go back to the story leading up to the destruction, do you remember how these armies came in and actually captured, they conquered and captured all the people in these cities? And Abraham came with 300 servants and rescued them. Must have been amazing, because I don't know how big the armies that came in were, but to conquer entire cities, and then for Abraham with just 300 servants to go and recover the captives, obviously God was blessing him mightily. And this must have been a wake-up call to these people that God was with this man Abraham. And yet, despite that, instead of saying, wow, we need to find out about the God of Abraham, they went back to their wicked lifestyle. And so the point where God said enough is enough. God always sends a warning first. And like he said, as it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. If we ignore the warnings that God sends us, then we're going to be doing exactly the same thing as those people in the cities. You know, God will send a message. He'll send a messenger, whatever it takes to wake up people. Wake up, you know, destruction is coming. If we ignore that message, then we've only ourselves to blame when the destruction comes. And the fact that it says these are in samples unto those who after should live ungodly, and they're visible today, is that not a message to today's society? Wake up, people. This is what happened in the past. You know, God doesn't change. He says, I change not. You know, there's some people who say, if God doesn't do something soon, he might have to apologize to the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Have you heard that saying? It's a poignant way of saying, you know, God does have a limit. He has a limit which he will not let people go beyond. And we know, as Jesus said, he's coming again. And as it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be. So what do we see in the world today? The same conditions.
You know, when it speaks of Sodom, you know, it talked about how there was a fullness of bread and everything. And it definitely is a lot like how the world is today in America, in New Zealand. I mean, you have that fullness of bread. And so it definitely is a warning to everyone.
So exactly. Fullness of bread, abundance of idleness.
Yeah.
You know, we're in the same conditions, and so it's leading to the same situation. Yeah, exactly.
Well, how can people support you, Ross? What is a way for people to look up more information on you and to support you?
I do have a website. It's discoverynews.net. So discoverynews.net. It's a website I've been meaning to develop more thoroughly. It's just got a few videos popped up there, but there is a contact page on there. So if anyone has any more questions or would like to know more information, you're welcome to go through that contact page. I'll happily Skype anybody or have a Zoom meeting if people want to have a chat like we've just had. So, yeah.
Yeah,
that's an option too. So, yeah, flick me an email.
Yeah,
if
I missed.
We can arrange it.
What was this discovery seminar in Indiana? Did you go to that or not?
Okay, now that's a good friend of mine who he did meetings as well. So he was doing that one. We're doing one next week in a town in New Zealand. We did one 2 weeks ago in another town further north in New Zealand. So yeah, we do these seminars all the time.
Yeah, so can you even travel to America? Are you guys even allowed to, or is it you have to quarantine?
Yes. Well, the situation seems to be changing all the time. Yeah, look, if I got an invite to the States, I'd be totally open to coming. If you come into New Zealand, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks at this point in time. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'd have to look up to find out what happens if we go from New Zealand to the United States. But look, you know, I'm open to that. We could find out if someone wants to do a seminar there. Be more than happy to find out what we have to do.
Yeah, that would be great to do a big seminar on it. But well, I really appreciate you coming on the show today, Ross. And it's a very interesting subject. I hope you have a good day and God bless.
Thank you very much, Paul. Much appreciated.
All right. Well, that was Ross Patterson. You can find out more information on him at discoverynews.net. And yeah, so I appreciate him coming on the program and talking to us. We got to get him on the show and talk about this Saudi Arabia, Mount Sinai, and the Red Sea crossing, because all these topics are fascinating. And so we'll talk. We'll have him back on, and we'll do more shows on this. I kind of just want to talk about Sodom and Gomorrah, the location, right now, because I'm into it right now. I wrote this whole script because I was going to make this movie on this topic. How long is this script? So it's just a short 19-page script that I wrote on this research. I did this, like, I don't know, a year ago or so, and it's just fascinating. It's a fascinating conversation. I hope you enjoyed this stream. We lost him there, the lost connection there for a little bit, but all in all, I think it went great. And he seemed like a nice guy. So hopefully I can make it out to New Zealand someday and interview him for the film. Or, you know, maybe we could do a conference, because that would be really neat too. But all right, guys. Well, thank you for tuning in to tonight's program. Don't forget to thumbs up this video and subscribe to our BitChute and Brighteon channels, because censorship, guys, it's out of control, and I want to make sure I get my audience over to those alternative sites just in case we get shut down. And so I appreciate everyone's support out there. I appreciate just, you know, all the love we've been getting through the website, through the emails, and just from orders, people ordering from the store. It is much appreciated, guys. We have a whole new line of t-shirts that we are going to be doing. I say we, I mean me. I made a video about this a while ago, but I haven't really talked about it since. I have gone crazy here, guys. I have started a new business, a new t-shirt business. And I can do hoodies, sweatshirts, whatever. I can do kids' clothes. I have gone big, guys. I got all the gear. It's all being shipped to me. And so it's not everything. There's like, I'm waiting on like three main things. So hopefully they will be here by the end of next week. So if you pre-ordered some stuff, I apologize. I expected to have these sayings earlier, but, you know, the coronavirus seems to be a great excuse for everyone right now. So we'll just blame the coronavirus on these sayings not happening. But, you know, if you guys want to get one of those shirts, you definitely help me out, because I've blown through a lot of money trying to set up this new business here. And so you can check out these new designs. We got Jesus is Essential, Fearful Thane. Hashtag Soul Winner, Surfing Monkeys, Evolution is Dumb. So we got a lot of great shirts on the website, as well as some conspiracy shirts too. Say no to mandatory vaccines. So go check out these shirts, guys. Support us at framingtheworld.com. And, you know, help me start this new business, because, you know, I've gone full board here. You know, I've been watching tutorials left and right. I feel like I'm going to be able to really do a good job with this. It's going to be like a whole, it's going to be like my own label. It's going to be my own clothing line, because I'm going to print my own neck labels. Like, I'm going to rip out the tags, do the neck labels. You know, the shirts are a way higher quality now because I'm not paying someone else to do it, you can get a higher quality shirt. So I'm going with a lot higher of a quality t-shirt this time. And, I really wasn't able to do this before returns as much before, because I was ordering so many of them. And, but I think what I'm going to start doing is doing more returns. So if people are not happy with their shirt for some reason, maybe it's just too small, maybe they just ordered the wrong size, that's no problem. So you guys have to ship it back on your dime if you ordered the wrong size. If there's some other reason, then that's on me. But if you ordered the wrong size, something, you pay for it to ship back, and then we'll ship it back to you on our dime. But we want you to be happy with the shirts you have, and especially now that I can just print another one. So we're going to start off small and start off small by doing one colors. We'll do a bunch of those, you know, and then once I master the art of the t-shirt, we'll move on to some other things, sweaters, stuff like that. So it's just something I've always wanted to do. And, I like to challenge myself. If you guys don't know yet, I like to do new things that challenge myself all the time. And it seems like I constantly am taking on these huge tasks. But you know what? I'm going to pull it off, guys. I'm going to pull it off. And you're going to love these shirts. So make sure to go to framingtheworld.com. Get one of the shirts today and support us. I really need some more pre-orders come in. And another thing is, if you order now, you only have to pay $14.95. So you get $5 off. So that's one benefit. Once the shirts are now shipping, I'm going to raise those all up to $19.95, and it'll stay at that because I don't have to do discounts as much to get rid of them anymore, because I'm not sitting on like this huge stash of shirts. Because before, you know, I would do one design and I'd have to buy 300 of them. And then if it's a hit, you know, it's great. You run out of sizes real quick. And then you have all these other sizes like, oh crap, I can't reorder till all these other sizes are gone. Just a headache. This way, you know, I can do a bunch of different designs and just print on demand as people want them, as people buy them, you know. And then obviously if it's not a seller, we just say see ya and we do a different design. So I think it's a great idea. If you have any t-shirt ideas for me, send them to paul@framingtheworld.com. I'll definitely steal your idea. Happy to steal your idea. But yeah, thanks for tuning in, guys. Share these videos. Help me get the word out about the show. Spread it far and wide. God bless, guys.